Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Seeing what others have seen, but uncovering what others may not. Global research that helps you harness disruption. Voted top global research firm 5 years running. Merrill Lynch. Pierce Fenner and Smith Incorporated.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have a spectacular guest. I have a very special guest. His name is Bill McNabb. He is chairman and CEO of the Vanguard Group, a small little shop in Pennsylvania that runs about $4 trillion. This is one of the few guests we've had back for a second time. We had him on 18 months ago, and there's almost no overlap between the two interviews. If you are either an individual investor, an institutional investor, a registered investment advisor, or a broker, this is a conversation you are going to want to hear. This might be one of the most influential people in all of finance. Certainly, Vanguard has become one of the most influential shops there are. It's called the Vanguard Effect. Any space they step into sees costs to investors plummet. A Bloomberg article not too long ago estimated that Vanguard has helped pull $40 billion in fees out of Wall Street's pockets and put it in the hands of investors by not only them charging a very low price, but by the competition being forced to compete with Vanguard and lower their fees. I'm going to make two recommendations for those of you who are listening to this. First, listen to the podcast, enjoy it. He's incredibly knowledgeable and eloquent, and I loved having a conversation with him. But second, go back onto iTunes or SoundCloud or the big picture at Ritholtz.com and pull out that previous conversation. I'll link to it on the blog when I write about this. You should really listen to both of these. They are a masterclass in the business of running an investment business. There's none better than Bill McNabb. With no further ado, my conversation with Vanguard Group's CEO and chairman, Bill McNabb.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is a returning guest. His name is William McNabb. He is chairman and CEO of the Vanguard Group, which currently manages just about $4 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Bill has been with the Vanguard Group since 1986, so his 30th anniversary was not too long ago. He became CEO in 2008 and chairman in 2009, and he is the third CEO in Vanguard's history, following Jack Brennan before him, and prior to that, a gentleman named John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard. Bill McNabb, welcome to Bloomberg.
Great to be here, Barry. Thanks.
And I should say welcome back to Bloomberg. The last time we had a conversation, it was really quite fascinating. So I want to jump right into some of the really interesting goings-ons these days and get the Vanguard perspective of things. Let's jump right to your competitors. How do you see the lay of the land when it comes to managing other people's money?
So I think what we're seeing right now is a, there's a secular change that's gone on and will continue to go on in terms of cost being a much more important component of investing. Obviously, that's played out most purely with indexing firms doing mm-hmm. better. But I think it's going to lead to further consolidation in the industry. We saw a week ago Janus and Henderson.
Big merger.
That was clearly a let's get more economies of scale kind of play. I think more of that may happen. I also think that you will see on the other side of it, maybe some boutiques emerge who are more specialized. And so you may end up with a more barbelled industry where you got a lot of really, nimble small players and, mm-hmm. Some larger players who can really exploit economies of scale.
So is it all about the economies of scale? Or when we look at, let's look at some of your competitors who are giant, BlackRock, PIMCO, State Street, These are all trillion-dollar firms. There are probably close to a dozen trillion-dollar asset managers around the world. Is that the cost of admission these days in order to get to where you can start driving costs down for investors?
You know, I think you could do it at lower levels than that, but certainly when you're at that kind of level, you know, you're spreading your fixed costs across a very large asset base, and you know that helps. And you know, I think Vanguard is like the purest form of transparency, if you will, into economies of scale. If you look at how our costs have come down over time, you can see the power of technology, you know, spreading fixed costs over a broader asset base and so forth.
It's been called the Vanguard effect, the impact of you moving in a particular space. Last time we talked about your desire to drive prices lower, but really, how much more fat is out there? How much cheaper can investing get?
Oh, it's, you know, we're getting down to, you know, it's an asymptotic kind of relationship at this point. And, you know, there's room to go, but it's not going to be the kind of declines we've seen in the last decade.
Most of the fat has been wrung out of...
I think that's right. But, you know, again, there still are economies of scale to be gained, Barry. You know, I'm such a huge believer in the power of technology. And in a sense, I don't know what I don't know. And the more you see in the technology arena, you know, some of the new things that are emerging, you know, the use of big data, the emergence of the cloud, I'm not sure we even know what we can do going forward. And, you know, we're spending a lot of time and effort in that arena as well.
So we're going to talk more about technology shortly. What about the people who are running some of your competitors? Do you ever get to chat with the Larry Finks and the Bill Grosses of the world?
So I was, until just a couple of weeks ago, chairman of the Investment Company Institute, which mm-hmm. is the Mutual Fund Trade Association. And as such, I met with many of the leaders in our industry on a very regular basis. And, you know, I get a chance to, you know, talk about industry issues, talk about regulatory changes with them. You know, I think Larry and I have actually shared the stage on a couple of occasions, talking about governance, for example, talking about long-term versus short-term. And so, yeah, you know, you get a chance every now and then to compare notes.
So we'll talk more about governance in a few minutes. Let's talk about the index fund. It just had a birthday. It just celebrated its 40th anniversary. Tell us what that means.
You know, it's an amazing thing. So, and this is really the power of Jack Bogle's imagination, if you will, mm-hmm. in 1976. So Jack, you know, had this concept that he had written about extensively that, you know, this idea of a broad market index might make sense. As you know from the history, Wells Fargo in particular, I think, did some work on the pension area and, you know, the first separate account. And what Jack did was he said, if it's good enough for a sophisticated institution, why not for everybody? Mm-hmm. And that was really the concept. And, you know, when it was first introduced in 76, people laughed at it. They said it's, you know, mediocrity, it's never going to work.
Un-American.
Un-American. Was,
Jack actually has hanging outside his office a print of an ad taken. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, it was, you know, this because it was viewed as almost communistic, right. People called it un-American. And, you know, for Jack, it was always a game of math. You know, at the end of the day, investing was going to become a zero-sum game. And mm-hmm. eventually, when you looked at active versus index, on average, the index guys were going to win. Just because both were going to add up to the market and one had a much higher cost structure than the other.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Bill McNabb. He is chairman and CEO of the Vanguard Group, which manages about $4 trillion. And let's talk about the size of Vanguard and what that means. You guys essentially own about 5% of just about every publicly traded company in America, and some proportion of non-U.S. equities. What does that do to your thinking about corporate governance issues? You guys really are the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to that.
You know, I think for us, Barry, it really underscores the unbelievable responsibility we have. You know, we are here representing, you know, the hopes and dreams of millions of investors who've entrusted their hard-earned assets into our funds. And so we've got to make sure that the the constituent portfolio companies are being governed in a sense with long-term value creation for the end investor as a very big goal. And we've had to up our game. We've had to increase our staff who engage in this. You know, the difference between us and, say, a traditional active manager, and we do have, as you know, traditional active funds.
About a third active?
About a third,
is that right?
Yeah.
That's still a trillion and change.
It's a lot of money. But on the index side, we're a permanent holder of these of these companies. And so you can't sell the stock if you're not happy with the way the company's performing.
But you can agitate if there's something. We could talk about gap accounting or stock options or CEO pay. If Vanguard says we're not happy about this, you're not a entity without resources.
So, and that's a really good segue into what I think has been one of the really interesting evolutions in the last couple of years, and it's been this whole concept of shareholder engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we really did agitate for, and you know, we gave, a couple of us gave talks on this maybe 2-3 years ago, and we've really seen a change in the way boards are working as a result. We said you need to engage with your big owners, not just Vanguard, but anybody who owns a significant stake. And you need to be thinking about how are you creating long-term value, not short-term. No one's interested in the short-term here. And so we have a set of principles that we ask people to follow in terms of governance. And that's the first sort of screen for us is
what sort of principles?
So, you know, we want
transparency.
We want the board, you know, composition to be right. We want the
defined by what do you mean by right?
You know, a complementary set of skills, independent.
Not just golf buddies of the CEO.
Totally. And real independence. And we want there to be linkages between executive pay and long-term value creation, and not short-term.
So, in other words, not paying people on the basis of how well the S&P has done recently.
Right.
Because that seems, by just granting stock options, you're basically compensating executives for what the stock market does, not how their company does relative to everybody else.
That's right. And you know, you've actually written a fair amount of this
on
your blog. And, you know, I'm in big agreement with a lot of your points there that in the 80s and 90s in particular, especially in the 90s after the compensation rules changed, there were a lot of just blanket granting of options, and it really was a rising tide opposed to performance really driving it.
Talk about unanticipated effects of a legislative change. For those folks who may not be aware of this, we changed the rules on exec compensation in the United States. We capped dollar compensation and pretty much allowed unlimited stock option compensation. And so people were paid not based on how well the company did, but how well the stock market did. So what can Vanguard do, and what can a board do to change that?
So I think what boards have been doing, and you know, there's actually been a couple of academic studies recently that have pointed out that there's been real progress here, is they have been doing a better job defining longer term objectives for the company and linking executive pay to those objectives. And you're seeing less use of options, more use of restricted stock grants. And the grants are made only if certain objectives are achieved. And then the vesting on those grants may actually take place over pretty long periods of time. We think that's actually helping drive executive teams to think longer term. It's still not, you know, it's not universal.
And it's not where it should be.
It's not where it should be. There's still too much short-termism in the market.
Is it safe to say you were in agreement with the Larry Fink letter of BlackRock, basically went out to the S&P 500 and some big European companies saying, hey, you're too focused on the quarter and you're not investing in R&D and you're not thinking long term.
Yeah, I give Larry and BlackRock a lot of credit for that letter. It was very complimentary, actually, to the letter, the last couple letters we'd sent out. You know, we had really emphasized with our portfolio companies that think long term. And, you know, we really stressed the need for better engagement. You know, he hit particularly hard on the long-term issues. And, you know, I think together it's actually a pretty good message.
So let's talk a little bit about other issues in corporate governance. What do you think about ESG investing, environmental, sustainable, and governance? Seems to be a rising theme these days.
Yeah, I think it's a very complex topic, you know. So I can tell you my mailbox is filled every week with different constituencies having particular social issues that they want expressed in the way we run money. Actually, I think if I added it all up, we would exclude almost every company in the S&P 500. So one of the things we've done is we created a socially responsible index fund.
The FTSE index.
FTSE. And, you know, it hits some of your big screens. And I think it's been successful at meeting a lot of investor needs. We see, it's a fairly significant fund at this point.
Is that only European or is that U.S. or global?
No, it's actually, it is a global phenomenon. And I could see us doing more in that product space over time, you know, perhaps adding a couple of more complementary kinds of offerings. I will say that the other evolution in ESG for us is looking at sort of broad ESG principles and how do they affect long-term value creation. And so, you know, the easy example would be if you have a company who's got a bad track record in terms of environmental issues, well, what you know is that's going to hurt the stock price over the long run.
I mean, it's a cost that'll eventually come back to bite them.
It is, and you see it time after time. So one of the things you can agitate for as a large owner is, hey, let's make sure we've got a long-term environmentally sound set of principles that we're operating under so the shareholder doesn't bear the brunt of that cost down the road. That's, you know, there's judgment involved there, obviously, in terms of how you actually have those conversations. But we're finding companies are actually doing a better job beginning to disclose that. You're seeing it more and more in some of the management write-ups and so forth in the proxy statements and in the annual reports.
Might we see a U.S. version of the FTSE ESG portfolio anytime soon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we clearly will have, I think, a range of opportunities for people.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is William McNabb. He is CEO and chairman of the Vanguard Group. They manage about $4 trillion, and he is the third CEO following Jack Brennan and Vanguard founder Jack Bogle. So, Bill, let's talk a little bit about technology. You referenced it earlier, the impact of it. What's the potential upside for technology as well as the downside that technology presents?
So we've historically approached technology as needing to do one of three things. You know, first, create automation where automation is possible so you can generate economies of scale for your investors. That's kind of classic automate things that are, you know, very manual in nature. You know, second, can you use technology to make your people better? So better systems so that when you're talking to clients over the phone or you're doing, you know, increasingly video conferencing and so forth with them, it's a better experience. And then the third is, how do you make it more convenient for your investors? So we've been, you know, historically trying to, I'll say, you know, bucket our investing that way. And it's been pretty productive for us. You know, one of the figures I always love to describe to people is in 2000, the internet was just starting to take hold. We had about $500 billion under management, 12,000 people. You know, today we're a little less than 15,000 people, and we have, as you referenced, nearly 4 trillion. So technology has actually made that possible.
So it's an 8-fold increase in assets, and you're barely a 20% increase in personnel.
Yeah, and as you know, during that period, the market hasn't been, you know, tremendous lift there. A lot of that has just been true organic growth. So we're able to do more for people. So, you know, technology's just been a phenomenal tailwind for us, if you will. One of the challenges I think we see in one particular area, and you allude to in your question, is, you know, the rise of social media and instantaneous information on everything.
Or misinformation.
Or misinformation. And as you know, one of the new sort of fads out there, or maybe it's more than a fad, maybe it's the way it's going to be, is get the headline out there or get the item out there, and then we'll check for veracity later. And we're seeing, you know, when that kind of information proliferates, it really does make investors struggle because, you know, they're like, what should I do? And of course, we're trying to counsel them, hey, there's noise in the system here. You need to avoid, you know, reacting to that noise. But the more there is, the harder it is to make that point.
Last time we spoke, two things. First, you mentioned the web call you did in the midst of the crisis. I would tell listeners, go find that. It's on iTunes and SoundCloud and Bloomberg.com and listen to that. But you were also just launching your robo-advisor, your automated investment platform. They've all come to be known as the robo-advisor. So that was with a few billion dollars. How has that been working out? What's it managing these days?
So we launched that last May, so it's about 18 months now. And as you allude, we had sort of a legacy business of about $10 billion at the time. It's now approaching 50 in 18 months.
And so I lose the bet. I said it was going to be 100 in a year.
Well, I think you're going to be right directionally, though. Mm-hmm. There's tremendous appetite for this in the marketplace. And, you know, our whole thing was to be able to give really sound, personalized advice for very small accounts. You know, we wanted somebody with $50,000 to be able to get the same kind of service that people with $1 million were getting just 5 years ago.
So you're anticipating my next question, which is what sort of pushback has there been? Vanguard is very popular amongst advisors who are fee-based. I know some people complained about it. They're obviously not interested in the $50,000 account. But what sort of pushback has there been, and what does Vanguard say in response to that?
So, you know, we'd be naive to think there's been no pushback. Although I can, you know, the mentions are in the dozens, if you will, from advisors. We serve something like 50,000 advisors today. And I think maybe I've heard from 100 over the course of 18 months. But, you know, you take it very seriously. I think my pushback is this technology is upon us, and this is going to happen.
You can't just ignore it and hope it goes away?
You can't ignore it and hope it goes away. And, you know, if it's not us, it's going to be somebody else.
Right.
And the real message here is let us help you work on your value proposition. I think it's more important than ever for advisors to be able to explain clearly what value am I providing to you as a client. The second point I think is really important is for advisors to look at this technology and say, what can I use, you know, technologically to make my business more efficient? I don't think any of the so-called robo firms are going to put the advisor community out of business. But I think people who ignore their technology are going to put themselves at risk.
To say the least. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is William McNabb. He is the chairman and CEO of the Vanguard Group, which runs a couple of dollars for investors around the world, close to $4 trillion. We briefly talked about the 40th birthday of indexing and the index fund. Let's get into a little more detail with that. There was a whole special in the Wall Street Journal about indexing and active versus passive investing. My favorite headline was "The Dying Business of Picking Stocks." I thought there was a little hyperbole there. Is stock picking really a dying business?
So I don't think so. I think there is a secular element to this shift to indexing, and it's really less about indexing and it's about cost. Mm-hmm. So I think low cost investing is the secular change here. I think there will be opportunities for active managers, but I think if you're a high priced active manager, you're going to really struggle.
So based on that, how can we explain the success of high-priced hedge funds, high-priced venture capital, high-priced private equity, of which there is always one shoot-out-the-light, spectacular fund, and then a whole bunch of, gee, we wish we were performing like that.
Well, you know, I think it does underscore that human behavior is always looking for, you know, the home run, right?
Right.
Know, people love that idea of, you know, outsized returns. Look, you know, if you take each of those three categories in turn, you know, venture, you should get paid for the risk you're taking
a
as
lot
a
of
venture
risk.
Capitalist.
Yeah.
And, you know, as an asset class over the last 15 years, it's done okay. And, you know, even more broadly than just the very, very best funds. And you're getting a risk premium for liquidity and for you know, the kinds of companies that you're investing in. I think it's a very vibrant thing, not accessible to the average investor. You know, private equity is an asset class over time, you know, at least the last 15 years, not been a great place. And I think your point on the fee side there is probably detracted from those returns. And again, by, you know, the way I look at private equity is, again, you should get a significant premium over the public markets for the liquidity that you're giving up. We don't see that over the last 15 to 20 years. You know, the hedge funds, you've written about that better than I'll ever be able to articulate.
I've had a few thoughts. It makes no sense to me.
It makes no sense to me.
My perspective has evolved in a minor nuanced way. If you're in one of those hedge funds that has a long-term track record of outperforming and they're continuing to outperform, well, why not stay with it? But finding those guys in advance, and it's almost always guys, but finding the emerging managers who are going to be the superstars, it's all but impossible.
It's very difficult. You know, a few of the big endowments have done a decent job identifying people early in their careers, you know, the Yales of the world and the Notre Dames of the world. And very few others have been able to do that. And,
Everybody who's imitated it has come to rue that chase.
And by the way, I agree with you. There are a handful of people who their returns in retrospect have been pretty persistent as well.
Yes.
So, you know, you look at the Seth Klarmans and the Steve Mandels of the world, and, you know, I have tremendous respect for what they've accomplished. And
all you need is a time machine to go back 20 years and give them money when they were taking it.
That's right.
So let's stay with the concept of indexing. One of the criticisms I hear all the time is we're at peak indexing. There's so much money has flown into indexing. It can't possibly continue to work.
So, you know, I think one of the things I love about your columns, you like data.
I do.
And so, you know, today indexing represents about 35% of the mutual fund world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where people focus a lot. It's only 15% of the U.S. equity market. It's less than 5% of global markets. So there's a long way to go here. Second, when you look at, I think even more importantly, trading volume. You know, in the U.S., indexing is like 5 to 10% of trading volume.
Well, isn't that because by definition, there's not a lot of trading going on?
That's exactly right. But the point is, we're a long way from, you know, where this could end up. And I think it's a global phenomenon, and you're going to see indexing take a bigger share of global equity assets over the next decade. I think it's almost inexorable. It'll be inexorable progress.
At what point is it too big, or is there just no point at that? Well, do we ever see this at 50% or 75%?
Well, I think theoretically at 100%, then you wonder where price discovery is coming
from. You're creating opportunities for stock pickers.
Right, exactly. I don't think there's a in the let's say the next 10 years. I think it's going to continue to grow. Whether it become, I don't think it become 50% of the U.S. market, even in that period, could be 50% in the mutual fund market.
Really, that of which right now it's 35%.
That's right.
35% of the mutual fund market. It's 15% of U.S. assets.
Yeah.
5% of global assets. Did I
hear
that
right? I think. Yeah. Less than
really?
Five.
That's astounding. Let me shift it up on you a little bit and talk about valuation. I keep hearing that stocks in the U.S. are overpriced, but I've been hearing that now for 4 or 5 years, and the market doesn't seem to care. It keeps going higher. Where are we in the world of stock prices?
So I would still say historically they're on the high end. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of sins get covered with, you know, essentially 0% short rates.
Sure.
And, you know, our view is hasn't changed the last couple of years. I've been pretty public about if we look out over 10 years, we think the central tendency is for equity returns to be a couple hundred basis points below long-term averages.
That's Bob Shiller's perspective. You don't use CAPE as a timing tool. Just look out 10 years, it'll tell you if you're at average, above, or below.
Yeah, and that's kind of our philosophy as well, Barry. And, you know, we run a lot of sophisticated models to get there, but that's where it ends up. And, you know, I think from a planning perspective, it's a reasonable place. The other sort of thing, and I can't remember if I read this with Shiller or not, but if you look at, you know, long-term treasuries, you know, take the 10-year and compare it, you know, a kind of typical equity risk premium, you get to the same kind of couple percentage points below long-term averages. So I think there's a lot of kind of convergence around that.
The difference, I just read this and I don't know who I'm stealing this from. With bonds, rates could go negative, but with yield on stocks, you can't get to a negative number because you're paying for the equity.
That's fair.
Let me mix it up with you again and talk about politics. We're recording this not too long before the election, the day before the last debate. What should the role of politics be in the average investor's portfolio?
So despite all of the headlines, despite all of the noise, despite all of the speculation, it really should play no role.
No role whatsoever.
No role whatsoever. We've looked at this going back to the 1850s. Mm-hmm. There's no difference that's measurable between having a Democrat president versus a Republican president. There's no difference, you know, on how the House and Senate work out. And so everything that goes on is kind of speculation. And what you typically see is some dislocations right before and right after, and usually within about 100 days of a new administration being in, you get back to kind of what we could call normal.
So it's noisy. You have some short-term ebbs and flows, and then
fades. It does. I think there is a bigger question out here, and you know, at always the risk of leading with my chin. you know, I would say there's some really good work that's been done. You know, at Harvard just issued their U.S. competitiveness study. I think just 2 weeks ago, Mike Porter and the gang, and we studied it pretty carefully. And you know, it's key takeaway for me was the political dysfunction that we're seeing is causing, you know, a real rise in uncertainty. And I think that uncertainty holds back growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a more macro issue, if you will, probably somewhat divorced from what's going to happen in the stock and bond markets in the intermediate term.
I can't say I disagree with a single word of that. Let's talk a little bit about buybacks. So we've seen a huge run of buybacks the past 5 or 6 years. Some people blame or credit those zero rates you were referencing. But they're starting to tail off. This year they've dropped a bit. What do you think the proper role of buybacks should be? Would you rather see dividends or investment? Or what do you think about the general buyback phenomena?
So I think the buyback phenomena has definitely gotten a lot of tailwinds, if you will, from the low rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't think levering up to increase buybacks is a good thing in general.
Now, some companies have done that because their cash is overseas and they don't want to pay the taxes on it.
Which is a whole broader issue. You know, second, I think the uncertainty that I talked about actually has caused a lot of companies to be more conservative with their cash. So mm-hmm. they're either keeping it on the balance sheet or doing what they can to keep their stock price up because they're so unsure about what the future is, they don't want to invest in the business. I would love to see us get away from that.
So let's talk a little bit about that overseas cash. The rumor, and we've heard it from both political parties, there'll be some sort of a deal for a cash repatriation, overseas capital repatriation, in exchange for some infrastructure spending and some reform of the corporate tax code. Is that feasible, possible, desirable?
I think it's feasible, and I think directionally desirable. You know, look, I think our corporate tax code is, I think, a hindrance to business here. You know, and again, I'm somebody who wants to see the markets do really well, especially here and in my home country, is we should have economic policies in place that actually are pro economic growth. And I think a more simplified and probably net lower corporate tax code would be beneficial in that regard. I also think getting clarity around international, you know, we're an outlier, as you know, in the developed mm-hmm. world in terms of the way we treat international earnings. And I think we shouldn't be going forward. I think it's those kind of policies are actually restricting good economic growth and long-term thinking. And we should be doing everything from a policy perspective to clear that up. The last point I'd make is I am a believer that infrastructure probably needs improvement here. In fact, it's not probable. It does. You know, I travel the world and—
Nice in Europe and Asia, isn't it?
You know, you see things. You know, sometimes I'd like to lift all of our lawmakers up and take them on a global tour. I think in order to promote, you know, good economic growth, you need to have some basic infrastructure in place. You know, no one wants to see higher government debt levels and so forth, but I think there's got to be some balance here.
Sure. Bandwidth in Asia, cell coverage in Europe and just the roads in Austria, Germany, Brussels. And, it's amazing.
And how about those airports around the world?
Spectacular. Yeah. Absolutely spectacular. We've been speaking with Bill McNabb. He is CEO and chairman of the Vanguard Group. If you would like to learn more about Bill's little shop, you can go to vanguard.com. There are regular bulletins, updates. The video from the 2009 crisis is up there as well. And be sure and check out our prior conversation. Be sure and stick around and listen to the podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things investing. Check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America North America. Member FDIC.
Welcome to the podcast portion. Bill, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really excited about this. You said something earlier off air that I have to ask you about. We were talking about Lehman Brothers and AIG, and your first day as CEO was September 15th, 2009. Is that right?
First 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. I became CEO August 31.
Right.
And I was actually standing on stage.
Where was this event?
This was in Washington, D.C. And we had our largest pension clients there. And,
right.
And I was giving my first talk as CEO, and the whole emphasis was on long-term perspective and right. the need to tune out the noise.
And of course, as the world is falling apart
around me. Well, I have a separate soundtrack going through my head saying, the world is ending as I know it. How am I, you know, how am I reconciling all this?
You got to look past this.
The really funny story, Barry, was our CIO, Gus Sauter, was due on stage a couple hours later, and we basically drafted his replacement and said, you're going to go give Gus's talk. And we sent Gus up to Valley Forge, you know, back to the offices to, you know, oversee the trading desk and make sure everything was working the way it should. And there were like no rental cars. So he ended up, I think, cruising into Vanguard's campus in a Mustang convertible.
Oh, that's funny.
And if you knew Gus, that was not his style. He was like a Pontiac Bonneville guy.
Right.
And so coming in, and especially with the world melting down.
The only story I know of that's similar to that, Dave Rosenberg used to be chief economist at Merrill. He was a government economist, like sleepy backwoods in Canada. And he goes to the private sector, and his first day at work is Black Monday 1987 crash. And he didn't understand that anything was unusual. He's like, wow, it's so exciting here. What are you talking about? The market's down 23%. Oh, this is not the normal? No, this is not how it usually goes.
Well, you know, actually, mentioning my former colleague, Gus Sauter, that was his second week on the job.
Really?
And he was running our then only index fund, Index 500.
Mm-hmm.
And it had about $1.6 billion, I think, at the beginning of the day, and then, you know, $1.2 billion at the end of the day.
Right.
And he went home, and his wife said, do you still have a job? You just lost a quarter of the fund. And he said, you know, I don't know. I have to go back and see if my badge still works the next day. And
so you told the story that in the midst of the crisis, you wanted to reassure your staff, all the employees, the 12,000 plus yep. employees at Vanguard, hey, you can't be nervous. You can't sound like you're afraid for your job, especially the people who are client-facing. What did you do to try and resolve that sort of tension?
So we told people, don't worry about your job. We're not going to have any enforced reductions. We want people to be there for the client. And, you know, we found, and what we told people, we anticipated there'd be some areas where the volume of work might decrease because the world was melting down. And if that happened, we would pick people up and we'd put them into areas that needed more help. Mm-hmm. And we ended up moving several hundred people around. But, you know, it turned out to be a great thing for us because the whole focus from that point on was what's the client need? And I think all of us who lived through that, you know, you certainly have the battle scars, but you also have a lot of pride in what we were able to achieve on behalf of our clients. And I think that message went a long way.
So I was at the Vanguard campus in Valley Forge when I met Jack Bogle, and it's a really large place. It reminds me a little bit of the Microsoft campus, which is just building after building after building. What was the thinking like? Because you were there, even though you weren't CEO at the time, to create this far away from Wall Street space in the hills of Pennsylvania.
Well, again, I give Jack Bogle a ton of credit for just he wanted there to be, for us not to be Wall Street. It was a very clear message from him. Actually, our predecessor firm, Wellington, was headquartered in Philly. Mm-hmm. Jack moved them out to the suburbs. I think part of it was tax reasons. Jack liked to save a buck for the investor. But I also think it was, a place to, in a sense, create separation so that people weren't unduly influenced by short-term forces. I think Jack Brennan, who succeeded him, built on that. I remember interviewing with him, and I said, so, what's your view of the future here? What do you want this company to look like? And he said, I'd like us to have Wall Street smarts with Midwestern values.
That's a good combination.
And, it really resonated with me, Barry. And I think the headquarters and the whole campus atmosphere really reinforces that.
Does that create a challenge at all in finding employees, finding staff? You're in Philadelphia, outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. It's from New York, I don't know, 2-hour drive maybe?
Yeah, that's 2 hours.
Does it make it difficult to find people? I would imagine that part of the world, it's a different salary scale than New York or San Francisco.
So it poses challenges occasionally. And the biggest place is if we're trying to bring somebody in at a more senior level from the outside, sometimes the dual career thing, in New York, there's just so many more opportunities.
Sure.
And that actually occasionally poses a challenge. But it's interesting. Once we get people to the area, mm-hmm. and they see the quality of living, it ends up turning into a selling point. I've just added 2 new members to our executive team in the last 6 months. And first time we've gone outside in a long time, more than a decade. And that was their reaction, both their reactions when they came. They're like, wow.
It's very kicked back. It's very chill. It doesn't feel like a frenetic Wall Street firm. A campus is really a good time. It feels like you're on a college campus.
And one of the, I would say, better to be lucky than smart aspects of where we are. And look, you should always acknowledge your luck.
Right.
There are 108 universities within 2 hours of our campus. We produce in that region more master's and graduate degrees per capita than any area in the country. I think on undergraduate degrees, it's between us and Boston. And so we've got a lot of young people who want to come and, they want to stay close to home. And we're really the biggest, financial services firm for, miles around.
I read a crazy statistic. I don't know if it's true. Something like 90% of the CFAs in the state of Pennsylvania work for Vanguard in Valley. Is there any truth to that? Is that a...
I think directionally it's
close.
It's close. I know certified financial planners, which is a broader thing. I think we have 50% now of the whole state. Yeah,
in Valley Forge. That's pretty fascinating. Let me take a look at some of the questions we might have skipped through before. So those are my favorite questions. We really covered a decent amount of stuff. We covered technology. We covered indexing. We covered ESG. We actually discussed buybacks, and all right, let's keep going.
Okay.
There's so much stuff to do, and at this point, I'm going to remind people, if you haven't heard the first conversation Bill and I had, which was 18 months ago, it's one of the favorite Masters in Business we've had. We got tremendous feedback about it. Really, there's almost no overlap between this and that. We've really covered very, very...
You've done a good job breaking that apart.
I've tried, and you also make it easy. I know how to anticipate what... there are some people where I ask questions and I have no idea what it's going to be. I have a general sense of what the Vanguard philosophy is. So when I ask Bill McNabb about indexing, you're not going to come out and say, well, I pretty much know where you're going to go with that. So let's talk a little bit about the evidence-based conference that's coming up, because we were discussing that off air, and I think it's interesting. So coming up in November, we have an evidence-based investing conference. You're one of the speakers, and you said you thought it was an interesting concept. Let's chat about that.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that's really fascinating to me is you spend a lot of time on data, and we think data rule. You know, it's a...
Not just your gut instinct? You don't want to go with how it feels at the moment?
Look, you know, there's a place for judgment and instinct. There's no question about that. But, you know, being well-informed and, you know, to me, as an analyst in particular, it's, you know, the second and third layers, if you will, when you're peeling that proverbial onion, where sometimes you really get the insights. You know, we have, just as an example, our chief economist has done some really cool work on, you know, what's going on from a growth perspective. And he doesn't accept the we're in secular stagnation.
I agree.
And he talks a lot about the evolution of tasks within occupations. And, you know, we take some comfort, if you will, that actually there's been a lot of change and it's been absorbed. And there's a lot more coming. And the question is, how well prepared are we for that? And, you know, it goes back to one of our earlier conversations around, are there things sort of from a policy standpoint that could be going on to help that? You know, we think infrastructure, we think education, probably the two big categories. But, you know, his work is so data driven that it makes you think a little bit differently about the problem. And that's what I loved about your concept. And I can't wait to see it.
The idea behind it is there are all these things that over the past 20 years worth of academic research, we've learned to be true. And it turns out that a lot of things that most of Wall Street used to believe turns out to be false. It looks good, it feels good, but in the real world, it doesn't work. So the idea was, hey, let's create a way to have a group of people come and discuss investing in markets strictly from what do we know to be factually true? What do we know to be have evidence behind it that demonstrates the veracity of a certain investment philosophy? When I sum up Vanguard for people, it's nothing matters more than costs. If you keep costs low, everything else, all other good things will follow. But that's not the only truth that we've learned to be true over the past couple of decades.
That's right.
And yet it's amazing how... So this comes back to the $4 trillion at Vanguard and the rise of indexing. And maybe this is a question better asked of Dick Thaler or Bob Shiller, but why have these truths taken so long to infiltrate the mind of the average investor or the institutional investor?
You know, I think it's because there is an irrational expectation that we, you know, many people have that I know... If I pay a little more attention, I can outperform. You know, in the simplest way, you know, one of the best lessons I learned, and, you know, it was kind of a blinding flash of the obvious, but I often say that's all I'm good for these days,
right?
Is average is not average. You know, people used to say indexing, well, you're just accepting average returns. Actually, that's not true. As you know, if you take the average index fund's return and compare it against the whole universe, you're gonna be in the top quartile from a performance standpoint over any long period of time. So you're not actually accepting being average. You're saying I'm gonna be in the top quartile, guaranteed. And you know, it's things like that that aren't intuitive to people, and you know, you need to sort of lay it out. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Thaler. We are huge fans of their work. You know, Thaler and Bernardsi in the 401k space did some of the best work where they took the behavioral principles and said, okay, instead of using it just to explain what's happening, let's use them actually to help influence what should happen. And this is where the idea of automatic enrollment, automatic escalation,
nudge, everything he talked about
nudges,
in the book.
The you know,
changing the default so that it's a positive outcome. So one of the examples in his book that I found fascinating is if your default organ donor check is set for yes, donate my organs, 90%+ of people in certain European countries that have that default donate organs. If you don't have that as a default, it's 10 or 15%. And there's a giant waiting list. If you change that default, suddenly there aren't people dying because there isn't a kidney available. Or
it's such a powerful thing. You know, we funded some work that Thaler and Bernardsi did in the late 90s. Well, it was probably early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And it really led us to get much more aggressive about, you know, the target date phenomenon and these auto 401k plans. And we've seen better results. I mean, and again, to your evidence-based principles, it's absolutely clear when you look at the investment results of people who have followed, you know, sort of where we've used behavioral finance to shape the plan design and shape behavior versus leaving people to their own. And you can see it, and it boils down to dollars and cents. You have more money if you follow these principles.
So let's talk about 401k and best practices. And I want to make sure I don't keep you here too long. We're pretty good on time. Best practices. So the default should be automatic, regular contributions, and should it be a target date fund? Should it be what should the default be for the typical small company setting up a 401k?
So I think the target date is the easiest one. I think any, you know, well-diversified balanced option will suffice. Mm-hmm. But the beauty about the target date fund is you can give, you know, you're a lot younger than I am, so you can
not that much younger.
You can get the equity exposure you need versus what I might need. Automatically, you don't have to think about it. So that's why I like the target date. And you know, I've made the point to you know, thousands of investors at this point. I don't care what your income level is in a 401k plan, whether you're making $25,000 a year or $250,000 a year. A target date fund is a great solution for you. Mm-hmm. If you want to put more time and energy into it, and you love this stuff, great. You can construct a portfolio. I don't think it'll do any better, but you know, maybe it's something that you get a lot of satisfaction out of. But I think this default thing is really powerful. And, you know, we're seeing almost every new investor who comes into the system just stay with the default.
And just leave it like that. Yeah. So let's talk a little institutional. I've seen white papers from Vanguard about, hey, a 60-40 portfolio has beaten nearly all of the alternatives we mentioned earlier, the hedge funds, the private equity, and the venture capital. How does Vanguard present itself to the institutional community? I've spoken at various state pension funds, and I'm astonished at the level of, let's just say, influence outside consultants have. How do you get past that? How does that work when you're dealing with either a CalPERS or you obviously don't want to speak to any specific client, but a state pension fund or a large retirement or endowment?
Yeah. So there's no question that there's lots of outside influences, whether it's the consultant community or other, you know, people circling around. And complexity usually is the friend. You know, the more complex the relationship is, the more complex they want the right solution to be. And again, we found simple works better in most cases. So, you know, we just go out and we try to tell the story. And sometimes it doesn't work right away. And mm-hmm. you just keep sort of knocking at the door and you just keep telling the story. In the 401k space, it's worked really well. In the endowments and foundations, we're finding in the sort of up to mid, you know, several hundred million dollars, we're actually, the story is really resonating there. Some of the big pension funds, especially in, you know, the states and so forth, we're having, you know, we don't have as much access there. Interesting, though, you are starting to see some of the messages that we've been promoting actually adopted. I don't know if they got it from us or they're coming up with it independently, but you're starting to hear some of the same things. Hey, maybe we're paying too much for investment management overall, and we need to think about a different approach.
What do you think happens in that space over the next decade? Because clearly everything's in flux. New Jersey turned out to have a horrific state-run pension fund. Lots of money went to hedge funds who coincidentally were donors to various political campaigns. There's a ton of conflicts of interest. New York City announced last year that they were relooking at their alternative investments and what they're getting for their bucks. We've seen that in California. We've seen that all over the country. So what does this dynamic mean going forward? Is there going to be a big shift? Is that already underway? What's happening in the institutional space?
So I think the shift is already underway, and some of the leading plans are actually moving pretty quickly in this regard. And you know, I think what you'll end up seeing is a little bit more bifurcation in what they do. So they will keep some non-traditional, mm-hmm. but it'll be more in the illiquid space where, again, in theory, it's less about the manager, although, as you and I know, maybe it's more about the manager than anybody right. wants to admit, but you should get paid more in some of those spaces. And then for the liquid portion, you're going to see a real emphasis on cost, I think. And you know, so you'll see more passive investing overall. My guess is that continues. I think the big wild card, and it is the most interesting part of the equation, is everybody is looking at the expected returns in the equity and bond market. And they're looking at their own assumptions for their plans, and there's a disconnect. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see some very prominent, you know, public plans that have, you know, 7.5-8% expected returns. I don't know where that's going to come from.
I can answer that question for you. They have an expected return of 5% on the equity, 2% on the bonds. You add 5 and 2, you end up with 7. Although any accountant will tell you the math doesn't really work out that way. I've had that exact same conversation with people, and the thing that I'm still wrestling with is, so those are fair numbers, 2% on fixed income, 5% on equity, and yet on the hedge funds, they have expected returns of 8-9%. And I don't know where these numbers came from other than someone once explained to me, well, we're a state entity, and if we have a shortfall in our pension, in the pension's expected returns, we have to actually add taxpayer dollars, so we'll crank up the hedge fund portion of it. They can't crank up the fixed income or the bond portion because everyone would scream about right. that. But somehow alternatives are generating a greater return at no greater risk than the asset classes they're trading. It doesn't make sense, but it allows them an out to not – it allows them to continually underfund their obligations.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing at least a, I don't know if it's a new breed, but you know, you're starting to see some serious leaders in that space say, wait a minute, we've got to reexamine what's been going on. So I'll be the optimist and say that people are going to start to get their hands around it, but it will highlight that there's going to be there's some real gaps here in terms of what's been promised and what's actually funded and how that plays out politically. I'll leave it to you to speculate on.
I will. Before I get to my favorite questions, I wanted to ask you, is there anything I didn't ask you or any topics you think are worth mentioning that we haven't discussed on air?
Boy, we've covered almost everything.
We really have, haven't
yeah.
we?
Yeah, I think we've hit it.
So let's jump to our favorite questions. So you joined Vanguard 30 years ago. What were you doing before Vanguard?
So I had two jobs before Vanguard. My first job out of college was teaching first year Latin at
okay.
a boys' school.
And of course, that leads right to asset management.
Totally,
I
and
that.
Coaching three sports. It was 1979. It was pretty deep recession. Unemployment was high. I was happy to have a job, and
right.
And my parents were happy to have me off the dole, and it worked out. And I loved it. It was a great couple of years, and then I went back to business school. My first job out of business school was at what's now JP Morgan Chase. It was the Chase part.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of different things, but the last thing I did was really work on a lot of highly leveraged transactions, actually undoing some mm-hmm. in for the most part.
What years were those?
So that was 83 to 86. And I got hired by Vanguard to be a guaranteed investment contract product manager.
What does that mean?
I had no idea when they were interviewing me. Guaranteed investment contracts were a fixed income instrument issued by insurance companies as an investment option in 401k plans.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just getting in the 401k business. And, you know, we wanted to take a little bit more sophisticated approach. I think we had $200 million in the program at the time. I'm pretty sure I got hired because Jack Brennan was intrigued by the credit background I had and wasn't convinced that we had analyzed the insurance industry properly for the GICs we were buying. And so I think that had something to do with it. I'm not sure why else, because nothing in my background really pointed to, toward that. But turned out, again, you'll hear me use the phrase over and over, better to be lucky than smart sometimes.
I totally agree. So you mentioned Jack Brennan. Who were some of your mentors?
So, you know, Jack certainly, before I worked directly for him, was somebody I would go to for just advice around career, family, how to think about business problems. Jack was one of the great strategic thinkers, I think, of the entire industry during his time. And, you know, he was just a really good sounding board for a lot of things. So he clearly was a mentor. We also, I became pretty friendly with Charlie Ellis before he came on our board. Charlie was running Greenwich Research. And I, you know, I really count Charlie as somebody that I learned a ton from. You know, his book is arguably one of the two or three greatest, his first book, you know,
Winning the Loser's Game.
One of the two or three greatest things ever written about investing. And Charlie gave me really, really good advice when I took over running the 401k business. And he kept focusing in on, don't worry about growth. Worry about the quality of what you're doing for your existing clientele, and growth will take care of itself. And, you know, of course, Greenwich did sort of an assessment of who was the highest quality provider. And I'll never forget coming when he came in one day and he said, hey, congratulations, you've won first time. And he goes, now you're the hunted. So what are you going to do? And, you know, it just
That's
opened.
A great way to describe that, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it just, so he was a really positive mentor.
By the way, for people who may not know who Charlie Ellis is, in addition to being on the Vanguard board, he worked with Swenson on the Yale Endowment, arguably the most successful endowment in history. Harvard's is bigger, but their performance has been appreciably worse. And Greenwich Associates were really a huge, huge institutional advisor for many years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Legendary.
Legendary firm, and really changed the nature of how people provided services in the institutional space. And then, you know, I have a couple of unconventional mentors. I have an individual, he's 86 now. He's like a second father to me. He was my rowing coach when
really?
I got out of college. And while I was teaching, he and I were coaches together, but he was also my coach because I was continuing to compete. And I actually owe him a lot.
What's his name?
His name is Jim Barker, and we still talk a lot. And I went to him when I was interviewing at Vanguard. And Jim lives in Roxborough, sort of in a row house in Philly. And we went, we got a couple cheesesteaks at what I consider to be the best cheesesteak place in all of Philadelphia, D'Alessandro's, and a six-pack of beer, and talked about life. And he was the one who really said, you got to go someplace where your values and your passion match up with what the organization's trying to do. And he said, you know, you got choice. He said, that's what it should come down to. And, you know, it was sort of the final thing I needed to, you know, like, I got to do this because, you know, Vanguard, there was something special about it 30 years ago.
Well, you'll have to let us know if it works out.
I'm still striving there. I'm still working at it, Barry.
I'm going to guess it worked out okay. So let's talk about investors that influenced you, because this will lead to a few people other than Charlie Ellis, who clearly is a tremendously influential investor. Who else do you think influenced your approach to thinking about the world of investing?
So, you know, it's interesting. You know, obviously, I have to say Jack Bogle. You know, his analytic approach and the way he tried to simplify everything was really powerful. We had a really great duo in that we had Jack as chairman and CEO and, you know, key thinker on all this. We also had Burt Malkiel, great Princeton economist, on our board. And I got some pretty early exposure to the board. And, you know, Burt's, again, Random Walk Down Wall Street, one of the greatest treatises ever written.
1.8 million. I'm sorry, is it? It's in the 11th printing. It's 1.5 million copies in print.
So, you know, I certainly have to give Burt, you know, a lot of credit. And then this may surprise you, given how important I think indexing is, but there have been a couple of active managers who I had exposure to fairly early on, and I just liked the way they think. And I actually think it's very compatible with the way I describe the power of indexing. And the great John Neff, who ran Windsor Fund for 30 years and one of the best track records ever for an active manager. The thing about John that was so powerful, and you know, your evidence-based investing makes me think about this, John knew the companies better than the companies knew themselves. Mm-hmm. And I can remember sitting in sessions where he would be going through the details of what was happening at a large, you know, a Fortune 50 company, and sitting across from the management teams, and they had no idea what he was talking about. And
really?
He was so much more in depth. And then there was another fellow at Wellington who sort of flew the public radar. But when you look at his track record, Ed Owens, who ran our healthcare fund, mm-hmm. and he's since handed it over to his successor, who's done a phenomenal job, Gene Hines. But Ed and his team, you know, that healthcare fund for 30 years, when Ed retired, no fund in the industry had a better track record.
Really?
It was, at the time, 400 basis points ahead of the next best fund in the industry.
Wow.
And the thing that—
When did he retire?
So about 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was so impressive about Ed and John was their knowledge of their companies was deep. But even as active managers, they were very much into long-term value creation. So you look at their portfolio turnover and it was really low compared to other active funds. And they actually took pretty concentrated bets. And, you know, I've come to believe that if an active manager is going to add value, it's probably going to be by being very different. So each of them would have 40 to 50% of their portfolio in their top 10 names. And, you know, coupled with an index as a base, that was actually a pretty good way to invest.
So that raises a question, not from our favored list, but we talked earlier about recruiting. You get rock stars like that who can jump ship to another place and maybe pick up a bunch of stock options and make more money. How does Vanguard retain their top talent like that?
Well, so, you know, interesting. On the active management side, some of those folks I referenced, they don't actually work for us. They
outside managers.
They're outside managers. And so, you know, if they work for Wellington or for PrimeCap or, you know, mm-hmm. any of the other firms around the world, Baillie Gifford in Scotland.
That's a pretty unique arrangement, isn't it, for a big mutual fund?
We're the only ones who employ this strategy as extensively as we do. And really, all of our active equity, with a couple of very minor exceptions, is run by external firms. And we scour the world for the best firms. And today, I think we have about 75 different mandates run by 30 firms. And it's been a really good way to approach active. And we find people who are aligned with us in terms of low cost and long-term view and so forth. You know, in terms of the broader question, though, how do we retain talent? Yeah, I'd say there are a couple things. One, you know, we do compensate people well. I mean, in our own firm, our fixed income teams, our index teams, our client service people, you know, we pay very strict attention to what's going on in the industry.
But you're reputed at the CEO level down. Look, if Jamie Dimon were to leave and you were to say, hey, knock, knock, sure, I'll run JP Morgan for you. I imagine JP Morgan with its stock options is a multiple of what you're— Not that you're underpaid at Vanguard. I'm sure it's a reasonable check each week. But when you go to any of the publicly traded Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, those are crazy numbers.
So it gets to the question, how much is enough, right?
Okay.
So, you know, at the end of the day, I think the kind of people we've been able to attract, look, we want people to make a good living. We want people to be able to take care of their families and, you know, support whatever.
But it doesn't have to be $100 million.
It doesn't. And, you know, we want people who are mission-based. And mm-hmm. the thing, and, you know, you've been to the campus, you felt it. I mean, everybody there is there because they really believe in the mission of the firm.
You don't feel that it's dripping with excess. And I've been to other places that you're like, what do you think that costs on the wall?
Yeah, there's a funny story. Somebody, a reporter came to my office a couple weeks after I'd become CEO, and she sort of looked around and she said, this isn't really what I expected. And she had been somewhere else where I think they'd spent $1 million on art or whatever. And she said, well, how much did that print cost? And that, and I said, well, it's a print. It was $15. And then we got it reframed. And, you know, and a lot of the art was actually went all the way back to Jack Bogle and Jack Brennan days. You know, it was just stuff we had. Look, we remind ourselves, and I know it sounds really Pollyannish, Barry, but it's not our money. You know, the question always
I don't think
me
that's
crazy.
Pollyannish at all.
You know, there's a question I get asked a lot out there. People say, what's it like to, you know, have $3.5 trillion or $4 trillion? I always like, I have no idea. I mean, it's not my money. It's, you know, we go to bed every night actually thinking about the responsibility that's been entrusted with us. And I think that's why the people are there. You know, you look at our senior team and mm-hmm. The tenure of our organization is incredible. You know, we have half the company has been in Vanguard more than 10 years.
Wow.
And I think, I don't have the stat right off the top of my head, but I'm going to guess it's at least 25% of the company's been more than 20. Mm-hmm. And that belief in what we do is really palpable. And, you know, you pay well, you make it a really good environment. And, you know, we try to treat people really well. There's no, this was a Jack Bogle-ism, you know, no problem, you know, in a sense, differentiating by how, you know, people's contributions are to the firm. But from a behavior standpoint, you know, Jack never cared what level you were. You treated everybody with respect. And I remember hearing, you know, learning that like my first 3 days there, just watching what was going on. And that really, again, for a lot of us, that's what gets us up in the morning.
There's a firm culture. It's still there and it hasn't attenuated yet.
You know, we work really hard at that.
All right, back to our favorite questions. Let's talk about favorite books. You mentioned Winning the Loser's Game by Charlie Ellis and Random Walk Down Wall Street by Burton Malkiel. By the way, two previous guests on the show. Yeah. What are some of your other favorite books, fiction, nonfiction, finance-related, or not?
So I'll give you two finance ones. So I can't not mention Bailout Nation.
You can skip it. Everybody knows what
but
that
everybody
is.
Knows that.
My listeners know.
Yeah. So it's, but it's, you know, again, you captured a lot. There's another book that I think does it's less extensive than yours, but gives everybody everything they need to know about that era. It's The Lost Bank by Kirsten Grind,
The Lost Bank.
It's about Washington Mutual, and it's a fantastic insight into what corporate culture, how corporate culture can go awry.
LOST, the Lost Bank.
Lost Bank.
Check that out.
It's really a good read. You'd enjoy it, especially given what you've done. You know, on the fiction side, so I tend to be accused of being very eclectic. I have a huge science fiction collection.
Me too.
And
who do you like?
Well, so I love all the classic guys.
Right.
So I've read everything. You
Zelazny,
know.
Asimov.
So I just reread Zelazny on a plane flight.
Which one?
This Immortal, which is
okay.
My favorite Zelazny.
Classic.
Dune, obviously. Hyperion by Dan Simmons,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorites. I love all the cyberpunk guys, Neal Stephenson in particular, and he's got a new great book out called Seven Eves.
Seven Eves.
I read this summer while I was on vacation, and it was fantastic. So that's kind of how I amuse myself in the fiction world.
How far into the cyberpunk do you go? You got William Gibson?
You know, I think Gibson, you know, Neuromancer is one of
sure.
my top books. Mona Lisa Overdrive, one of
right.
my favorite books. So I like those guys. You know, to me,
how abstract do you get with science fiction?
You can test me.
Philip K. Dick.
I've read them all.
Really?
Yeah.
You haven't read Ubik.
I've got Ubik. I haven't read Ubik. So you're right.
I read Ubik, and I'm the only person I know who's read it.
And I started Ubik, and I couldn't figure it out.
It's the spray. It's
yeah.
People don't realize, decades after he passed away,
yeah.
his books became these Hollywood Blade Runner was based on a short story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Total Recall was based on We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. So if when someone tells me they've read Philip K. Dick, I know that they've gone through the whole genre.
And one of the best new TV series.
On Netflix, or is it Amazon Prime?
It's Amazon Prime, and it's The Man in the High Castle. They did it. It's a pretty good treatment.
I'm halfway through the first season.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good extrapolation of
and
what
it
the
looks
book,
great.
Yeah, it makes me think of what I read. So yeah, I love all that stuff.
Yeah, that was really a fascinating book. A talk show host awakes one morning to discover that America has lost World War II and the Japanese and Germans have split up America, and he can't figure out why. So they haven't quite gone that
right.
route. But in the book, it's this Dick loved alternative levels of reality.
It's a I like to say I misspent my youth and my adulthood reading a lot of science fiction. But you know, for me, it's actually very stimulating because things like, and you know this, cyberspace,
sure,
virtual reality. This has been part of my world for 20 years. So watching
technology is always 50 years behind science fiction writers.
And so,
like, you could look at every major innovation, and somebody was writing about it half a century ago.
Yeah, I'm now about to start a new book on that's about the XPRIZE, and you know, the first group to win the XPRIZE in you know, launch.
Was this space launch or the driverless car?
Space launch.
Okay.
And so I'm really interested in.
What's the name of the book?
You know, I'm drawing a blank now. It just came out, and it's literally, it just showed up on my doorstep.
And before I so rudely interrupted you talking about science fiction, what was the other fiction that you were going to reference?
No, I think that's the where I spend most of my fiction, and then I do a decent amount of history for nonfiction.
What have you read recently you liked?
So my favorite one in the last couple years is a book called Valiant Ambition by Nat Philbrick.
Valiant Ambition.
And
okay.
it's basically a follow-up to a book he did a couple years ago called Bunker Hill. And it's the second year of the Revolutionary War, and it's really he focuses on Washington and Benedict Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
You get a really deeper appreciation for what led to Benedict Arnold's treason, and it's a story I didn't know, so it was really fascinating.
Huh, that's interesting. And if memory serves, you liked McCullough's Wright Brothers.
I love Wright Brothers.
You loved it.
Yeah.
Can I tell you, it's one of those books that have been in my queue. And I just haven't gotten to it.
When you read it, you're so inspired.
Really?
By
lot of people love that book.
So, you know, what's so interesting to me is these guys had a vision and they didn't let anything get in their way. And they just kept pursuing it. And the discipline and the passion, you know, it's everything I love. You know, it's the American dream writ large.
All right, let's keep going because I know I only have you for a few more minutes. So there's a new question I've added to my regular list at the request of listeners. What is it that you do to keep mentally and or physically fit? What do you do to relax outside of the office?
So I have a background in endurance sports, and in particular in rowing. You know, I took up rowing in college, and I could argue that it was taking up rowing that's led to everything. You know, it led me to take the teaching job in Philadelphia so I could continue rowing. It brought me back to Philadelphia. You know, this coach I mentioned as a mentor gave me the best career advice I've ever gotten. And in a sense, everything good that's happened since I can trace back to that decision to start rowing. So I'm pretty passionate about the sport.
Are you still rowing regularly?
You know, it's hard with my schedule. So I'll go out on the weekends. I have a shell, a single, and I will occasionally jump into a team boat. I'm going to actually race this coming weekend in Boston at the head of the Charles in a Masters event. So
really?
They age handicap it, which in my case is really necessary. And I'm going to row with I'm rowing in two events, actually, which I may regret later. I think they may need oxygen when I'm done, but I'm going to row with three of my teammates, and the first time we got in a boat together was 41 years ago.
Oh, really?
So it's pretty cool to,
that's amazing.
To reunite, and then I'm going to row with another group of alumni.
They all still stay active rowing?
They do, and what we do is we all try to get together and race this race in Boston periodically. And then the other thing I do with actually a number of my Vanguard colleagues is I bicycle, and we typically do one or two charity events in the summer to raise money for cancer. There's one in Massachusetts that's, again, you'd love it from just an economic standpoint. $40 million raised in one weekend.
That's big.
To benefit Dana-Farber and cancer research, and in particular, a lot of emphasis on pediatric cancer. And it's a really cool event. And I think this past year, we probably had 10 or 12 of us go up and do it.
So how does the money raising work? Is it a per mile, per that,
you know,
that sort of?
However you want to do it. You tell the organization you will raise a minimum of, I think the minimum is probably $4,000 or $5,000 now. And you get sponsors, friends. You know, my wife and I tend to, you know, it's cancer research pretty important to us, so we tend to do it ourselves, but everybody has their own approach. And it makes you train. You know, it's 200 miles in 2 days.
Double Centurion. That's pretty impressive.
So, you know, I can't fake it through that anymore.
No.
So I've got to keep
What do you do to prep for that?
So again, long rides on the weekend, and we have a gym on campus. I'll do a spinning class a couple times a week. And
so there's really a lot of, you're getting ready to do, that's a big ride, 100 right. miles a day.
But, you know, to your original question, I find that, and this was a lesson I learned from Jack Brennan, the discipline of staying fit has helped me immeasurably career-wise. You don't get sick as often. Your stamina is great. You know, when you go through crises, long days just sort of bounce off you.
Right.
And so to me, it's become very self-reinforcing of kind of basic leadership principles, you know, something that you want to emulate so other people do it.
So you have to take care of yourself so you can take care of business.
Yeah, totally.
That makes sense. Our last two and favorite questions. What sort of advice would you give to a millennial or a recent college graduate who might be interested in going into the field of finance or investment management?
So I think it's a really interesting time for that. And, you know, I'd always tell them, whatever sector they're going into, the economy, but in particular in financial services, find a place where your values match up. So, you know, really probe a lot around the values of a firm. And you got to go to a place that you're comfortable with and that where your values really match up. I think very related is have a passion for it too. Don't do anything just for the paycheck. And you know, sometimes, I mean, you know what it's like coming out of school, you're in debt and you're tempted to just do whatever to meet those obligations. But I think passion is really important. You know, when I first came out of school, I did have a passion around education. So, you know, the first couple of years for me, you know, I got to fulfill that. You know, my first foray into finance, I wasn't as connected from a mission standpoint. And it was finding Vanguard that really reinforced how important that is. I was just so much happier about the work.
Makes sense. And our final question, what is it that you know about the world of investing and running a company today that you wish you knew 30 years ago?
30 years ago.
Crazy number, right?
Yeah. I think the speed with which technology is evolving is much, and you know, here for a science fiction guy to
sure.
admit this, it's really hard, but I didn't see it all coming as fast as it came. And I think it's because it's not linear. I don't think humans are wired to think exponentially.
Just the smartphone was such a, people don't realize there's more power in this than took men to the moon.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how that's changed
so,
the universe.
So, you know, not having as good an appreciation about that. And then I think it's probably related, but the globalization that's occurred, especially the last decade, it's spectacular, but also, you know,
it comes with challenges.
It comes with a lot of challenges. And I think that's really, you know, if I could go back in time and anticipate that a little better, I think I would have made smarter decisions in terms of helping us as a firm think through some of those things. I think we've done okay, but those two phenomena, the acceleration of technology and globalization, again, probably very interrelated, they really are defining our era in so many ways. And I think they're going to define the next 10 years too.
I don't doubt it for a second. Bill, thank you for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking, I want to make sure I say this right. Is it William McNabb III? Because I keep calling you Bill.
Bill is what I prefer.
Okay.
It's technically Frederick William III, and my mother insisted that I be Bill since my father was Fred.
All right, that works. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the other 108 or so such conversations we've had. If you want more information on Vanguard, they're a small company in Pennsylvania. You could go to vanguard.com and learn all about them. I would be remiss if I failed to thank Taylor Riggs, our booker, Michael Batnick, my head of research, and Charlie Vollmer, our recording engineer. We love your comments, feedbacks, and suggestions. And if you've made it this far into the podcast, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.